Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. Today in the show, we're going to talk a little about insect control, especially in soybeans. But you know what? A lot of the insecticides and a lot of the concepts we're going to talk about apply to all crops out there, and also to gardens, to lawns, to flowers. There are a lot of things that, you know, we can discuss when it comes to insect control. So we'll get to that today. If you've got any questions for us, we'd love to take your phone call. Our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can email us, radio@agphd.com, or send us a note on Twitter, AgPhD Media, Darren Hefty, or Brian Hefty. We are live in the Morton studio today. Before anything else, I just had a couple of quick announcements for you to begin with. Next week, we are going to be doing one of our last, or a couple of our last AgPhD winter workshops. We'd love to have you attend those on Monday, right at our field day site near Baltic, South Dakota, which is just 10 miles away from Sioux Falls, by the way. You can attend the 101 Ways to Cut Farm Expenses Today workshop. On Tuesday, we've got Secrets of High Yield Fields, where we're going to be looking at soil tests and tissue analysis from high-yield farmers from around the country and even around the world, and just talk about what are some of the tips that we've gotten from a lot of these really high-yield producers, and what things can you learn from them, and just flat out from high-yield fields, and you know what, even from your own fields, that can lead you down the path of higher yields and higher profits in the future. So that's Monday and Tuesday next week in Baltic. Now, on Monday, in addition to our 101 Ways workshop, we've got a special grain marketing session right away in the morning. And then after we get done with our workshop during the day, Bear is going to be doing some dicamba training. If you need dicamba training yet, you can qualify for this, and I don't care what state you're from. In fact, just today, we got an agreement made with the state of Iowa, so we got that one taken care of too. I know about a week ago or so I had said, we've got this dicamba training coming up. If you're from the Dakotas or Minnesota or Nebraska, you're going to qualify with this training. But if you're from Iowa, you can't. Well, we got that taken care of because the training's exactly the same in every single state. So if you want to spray dicamba later on in the season, or really at any point during the season, I should say, on Xtend crops, you must attend a dicamba training. Now, I would say this, even if you don't raise Xtend crops, this is a good training to go to. There's a lot of basic stuff that you need to know when you're spraying anything on your farm. We just think it's tremendously important to do the job correctly. Not only is it the right thing environmentally and the right thing for your neighbors, but it's also the right thing for you in the pocketbook. If you do the right things, you're going to get better results out of anything you spray. So I would highly encourage you, if you haven't attended one of these things, come to the 101 Ways workshop on Monday and then stick around after that for this dicamba training. It takes a little over an hour for the dicamba training afterwards. No big deal, but it's great information for anybody who sprays anything.
Well, it sure is. And, you know, the dicamba training will help you getting the weeds under control in your soybeans. Today, we're going to talk about controlling the insects in your soybean field. And, Brian, this one's up for a big debate because I talk to farmers all the time and they say, all right, let's just take diseases out of this. Let's say, all right, these bugs aren't vectoring any disease. They're not going to carry any disease. I'm not going to have disease later because I'm in a dry climate. All I'm worried about is feeding on my foliage, and I see studies that say, well, when there's hail and it takes 25% of my foliage, 50% of my foliage, it really doesn't take that much yield away from me. How do you debate that? Do you go right to, well, insecticides are cheap right now, or do you say, well, you know what, maybe you should invest your money somewhere else?
Like anything on the farm, we want to look at, on average, is what I'm doing going to pay? Now, certainly you have to look at what are the risk factors. Obviously, you're at much greater risk if you have higher insect numbers, if you have a higher crop price, if your insecticide is really inexpensive. We're looking at the overall economics of this thing and can it pay this year and can it pay on average? But yeah, I was busy thinking about when you said the disease thing. I'm going to have bug feeding, but I'm not going to have disease after that because I'm in a dry area. And I just got thinking about, okay, how about human beings? Human beings and plants are very similar in many ways. We both can get diseases in us. Well, one of my concerns here is this, that we start thinking, well, I'm in a dry climate, I can't get disease. You know what? It's super dry in my house, in my office, on my farm, every day right now in the middle of the wintertime. But you know what? People get sick. So the same thing can happen with your plants. If there's enough disease present, it's gonna happen when you've got open wounds in your plant, like you will when you get insect feeding. So here's the thing. You just want to look at what's the economic threshold, and I say economic threshold for any insect. It's extremely low when you're already out there spraying anyway, and your cost for insecticides $2 an acre. So I guess when you look at insect thresholds from different universities, different publications that are out there, make sure you're putting in your true costs and your true risk, because what I find is many of the results are grossly misstated. So I'm serious. Our cost on insecticide now, $1.50 to $2. That's it. If I'm already out making a trip already, that is my grand total cost. How many bugs does it take to justify an extra $1.50 or $2? Not very many, I can promise you that.
Okay, now I got a couple arguments for you. So one, that's true if they're not resistant to pyrethroids. Now we're starting to see in Minnesota, okay, for example, some aphids resistant to pyrethroids, but you've got other choices. And I would still argue for that low threshold because we can spray stuff like Safina or Transform or hopefully someday Savanto Prime
Prime's already fine, but Safina is the one that we don't have a price on. Oh yeah, we got
Savanto Prime isn't labeled for soybeans yet. Still labeled in...
99% sure it is. Just looked it up the other day.
Okay.
But anyway.
Well, maybe they did get a soybean. I thought they were only labeled in the bench. You might be right.
But
well, anyway, there's several
Savanto
different
Prime
chemistries.
Very expensive. That's $15
an
acre.
There's several chemistries here that will kill aphids that are resistant to pyrethroids, but they're pretty easy on the beneficials because they're very specific.
Yeah, but Lorsban's $4. So it's double the price of the pyrethroid, but double the price is only $4. It is not much.
Well, one thing's for sure, we don't want to have insects feeding on our crop. We're going to talk specifically today about insects in soybeans. We're also going to take your calls and questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. Stay tuned.
Every farmer knows that in order to be profitable, you need to maximize the return on your crop input investments. Hi, I'm Scott Harms, an agri-risk specialist with Grain PhD. Without an effective and flexible strategy, your grain marketing plan gets stuck in the mud. With Grain PhD, you get the clarity and guidance a solid marketing plan needs. Our free Grain Bridge software simplifies your cost-profit analysis, and our risk specialists are here to help you develop your plan. Sign up today at grainphd.com.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply EndoPrime SC. MycoApply EndoPrime SC uses four specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply EndoPrime SC at EndoPrimeCorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Using N-Serve Nitrogen Stabilizer with fall fertilizer applications keeps nitrogen available into the spring for maximum crop growth. Field trials in Iowa show N-Serve delivered an average revenue increase of $22.96 per acre, and N-Serve is the only recognized nitrogen stabilizer product in the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy because it reduces nitrate leaching. That's max profit in an environmentally sustainable way. Calculate your field's profit potential at nitrogenmaximizers.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, along with my brother Darren. We're live in the Morton studio today talking about insect control in soybeans. Before we get back to that, I just wanted to, I guess this does pertain to that, but we were talking about Savanto Prime right before the break, ran out of time there. That absolutely is labeled in soybeans. It's very expensive, but it is, to Darren's point, a little bit, it's a different mode of action. It is a little bit different in terms of you're not going to have as much negative impact on the beneficial insects out there. So that is a big advantage. But yeah, we've got a few different options for you in terms of aphid control if you're dealing with resistant aphids.
Okay, talking about insects in soybeans, it's not just aphids. There's a lot more bugs out there. We've got Carlos Granadino with Valent right now to talk a little more about this. Carlos, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. Appreciate it.
All right, when you think about bugs in soybeans, it depends on where you're at in the country. There's a lot of different ones that are out there. What are the insects that are most concerning for you?
I think when we look at the landscape right now, the game changer will be the soybean gold midge for many reasons. I think the little that is unknown, and if you look at the pattern of distribution, that is kind of like first it was found in Nebraska, and if you look at moving the straight line to the north, kind of follows the kind of the stream of wind distribution there. And when you look at the damage that it can do in the different situation of soybean cropping system, I think it's a concern because it can trigger many unwanted and undesirable outbreaks of other pests as well.
You know, I like that you brought this bug up first, Carlos, because this is one that I've been watching here for the past 4 or 5 years now in southern South Dakota and northwest Nebraska. Now it's spreading from there into multiple states and a pretty big geography. Do you have any answers? We really haven't found anything that's worked yet. I hope you're going to tell me, oh, yeah, we're working on it, Darren, and we're pretty close.
Well, Darren, I wish I could tell you otherwise, but no.
Dang it, Carlos, so, come on. You got to help me out here. We need some help. We started seeing them last year. I found one plant on our farm that had gall midge larvae in it. So if I found one, that means there's probably a bunch more that I didn't see yet. So I know we're going to start facing this one pretty hard right at home.
That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, I think the first line of defense will continue to be the seed treatments. I believe the issue we in the industry encounter is that the rate that we have in the seed treatments as today might not be enough to control this particular insect. And it will vary, right, depending on the product itself. But nevertheless, you know, it's something that we're working on it, Darren. We're looking at higher rates of seed treatments to see if we can, you know, get a proof of concept. If we are able to knock it down early in the season, that might be a great benefit to the growers.
That would be awesome. And I think we're going to need something systemic for a bug that is inside our soybean stems. What about one that's on the outside? What about brown marmorated stink bugs? We hear a lot about stink bugs in general, but also or especially these brown marmorated ones. What are we doing there? What kind of treatments are we trying to go with?
Right now it's all obviously foliar. You know, for the stink bugs, it's quite difficult to get them just with systemic products. So, you know, you have the gamma of pyrethroid insecticides. You know, we have products like Asana, we have Belay. You know, they're pretty consistent with that. And, you know, obviously you have more options in the marketplace. But given the, you know, the imminent distribution of the pest, as you recall, it started in the Northeast, right? And now you guys are facing it in the Midwest. So early damage will be the main concern for the soybean growers. So you have to stay vigilant and have a foliar alternative right away to nail them down.
Yeah, it's getting tough. And I like, you know, a couple of things here that we've talked about is starting with that seed treatment. Neonic is just becoming so critical with early season being leaf beetle control and even helping reduce our aphid pressure a little bit. But yeah, as we go forward, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of trial work done this year on varying rates and seeing what kind of impact we can have on problems like gall midge larvae and others. Been talking with Carlos Granadino with Valent. Carlos, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on today.
Okay, no, thank you very much for your time. Take care.
We've got Ryan Henry with us right now. He's out in the state of Illinois. And Ryan, you know, lots of bug problems here in the western Corn Belt. How about right in the middle of things where you're at? What are you seeing in the soybean crops?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for having me on first. And yeah, you're right. We face bug pressure in soybeans here in the Midwest quite often. I would say that the number one pest on soybean growers mind would be soybean aphid for sure. We also face bean leaf beetle pressure that can come on pretty strong in some years, but the number one would certainly be the aphid pressure.
You know, you hear about states like Minnesota where they're starting to see resistance to pyrethroids. What are you seeing with performance with some of the alternatives?
Absolutely, yeah, that's correct. We are starting to see resistance with the pyrethroids, and we have several options for aphids that might be resistant to that class of chemistry. We have acephate, which is a good alternative. It's more common in the cotton-growing areas, so the Mid-South, but it is a good option for resistant aphids. And then we also have a new product, Argyle, which would be new to soybean growers for this year. It's a pre-mixture that includes bifenthrin and then acetamiprid, which has very good activity on resistant aphids.
You know, we're starting to see more of that in a lot of different parts of agriculture, not just weed control and fungicides, but also now in insecticides. We're seeing multiple modes of action. What does it gain you when you're going with two different modes of action out there, other than just avoiding these resistant aphids?
Well, with the two different modes of action, you get broad spectrum control, which is important, especially important for insect control in soybeans. It also is important that it allows both, depending on the premix, it can allow both contact and systemic control of pests. So it really broadens the time frame of control after the application and also the different pest types.
You know, I think that time frame is kind of a big deal, too. We talk a lot about spraying on the early side, and most of the growers that we talk to that are really shooting for high yields, they say one of the keys has been trying to get the bug outbreaks before they go crazy in their fields and really cause a lot of damage. So that's something I know quite a few growers are looking for, just improving that length of control. What do you see, you know, when you're looking at insect control around the country, what are some other things that growers are doing to improve yields and get more out of their insect control products?
Sure. Well, one of the first thing that comes to my mind would be seed treatments, and I think that that topic was discussed with the last caller, and I would agree that seed treatments can allow for a grower to maximize the yields because it does give that first line of defense against pests. The seed treatments will allow for early season control and also allow the flexibility for late season control from foliar applications.
Yeah, I think, well, we see this with almost everything we're doing. We're trying to layer our approach where all throughout the season we're, okay, let's get some coverage here. Let's get some more coverage a little later. And that way we aren't totally relying on just that one shot making such a difference. Last year in a number of areas of the country, though, we saw some bugs come even later, and it was still a challenge. You know, when do you have to stop looking? I mean, to me, I'm not feeling safe until the combine runs through the field.
Well, and I think there's several different researchers across universities that are looking at that timing of application and when to end. I think generally the consensus is that after about R5 for soybeans, insecticide, the benefit of an insecticide application really falls off. Of course, that depends on the insect that's present in the field, but in general, I think that R5 growth stage would be the cutoff for most insecticide applications.
Well, fortunately, we've got a little bit of time here to wait in the Midwest before we have to start addressing these bug issues, but I really appreciate getting prepared. I've been talking with Ryan Henry as well today. Ryan, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
If you've got questions about soybean insects or specific management practices in your soybean crop, give us a call today at 844-44-AG-PHD. We'll be right back.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro-liquid fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro-liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence, too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutec's EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutec's EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutec's EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
Hey, Bill, any advice to control tough weeds and rootworms?
That's easy, Jim. Buy two, save three.
Wait, for weeds and rootworms?
Buy two, save three. Combine your Impact or new Impact Z herbicide purchase with a qualifying insecticide and save $3 per acre.
Buy two, save three. That is good advice.
For details, go to buy2save3.com. Impact, Impact Z, and Buy 2 Save 3 are trademarks owned by Amvac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? The Soil Warrior can reduce trips across the field, optimize nutrient placement, and improve soil health. So you can lower production costs without losing yield. See what makes the Soil Warrior different and better at SoilWarrior.com.
The Guardian Air Twin Spray Nozzle from Hypro produces a twin spray pattern with air inducted droplets for superior coverage, even in dense canopies. Be effective and efficient with your spray application this season with the Guardian Air Twin. Hypro, helping you spray better.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. Well, you're probably wondering by now if you're a fan of the show. We were talking about insect control, and we haven't brought Bob Hooten on yet, so guess who's up next? Bob Hooten from FMC. Bob, thanks for joining us.
No problem. We're out here at the National Farm Machinery Show, 56 degrees out here.
Yeah, just rub that in. Rub that in. And we're 10 to 20 below wind chill here today watching the snow blow around. Okay, so you're in that 56 degrees. What happens to insects in Kentucky then? Do you lose a lot of them over the winter, or do some make it all the way through?
No, for insects are pretty tolerant to cold weather. You figure they've been here, you know, since before the dinosaurs, so they're used to this weather. And it takes an extremely cold winter without any snow to actually have much of an impact. Now, sometimes it'll delay things a little bit so that maybe the bugs that you're going to see in mid-June won't show up until the 1st of July. But we will get those stink bugs. We will get the bean leaf beetles. We'll get everything that we're used to in soybeans.
You think even, Bob, in North Dakota, where we've had a lot of temperatures 20 and 30 below, wind chills 50, 60, 70 below zero, in some areas they hadn't had a lot of snow until the last couple of weeks. Do you think even there we're still looking at normal levels of insects?
Yeah, what you'll have basically most of the time in North Dakota, you're going to have a lot of insects that actually blow up from the south.
Yeah.
So depending on how we have spring weather, and it's not storms necessarily in North Dakota. It's springs down south that kick them into the air. They'll go up 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 feet, and then they'll eventually drop in probably Nebraska area and then blow on up into North Dakota a little bit later. So what you're going to be watching for, a lot of stink bugs that'll be coming up. You're going to be watching for some bean leaf beetles that'll overwinter. They will tolerate pretty good because they crawl down deep into the soil. The wireworms and grubs that are deep in the soil, they'll go very deep, and then they'll come up as the wet temperatures warm up. So Now your aphids are going to might be down a little bit this year. So I'd be looking for the early season insects more so than I would some, say, the aphids, things like that.
You've mentioned stink bugs a couple of times. On our own farm here, and we farm in southeast South Dakota, we've seen stink bugs before, but only a few every year. Last summer, I'm walking fields, and I saw probably, 50 to 100 times more stink bugs than I normally do. Can I expect to see more of that? Do you think that this particular bug, stink bugs, are moving further north and west as we raise more soybeans and some of these crops that we didn't used to raise years ago? What do you think is happening with stink bugs in general?
Well, 40 years ago when I'd sweet beans, you couldn't find anything. This, you know, right. Past year you could sweet beans and find a little bit of everything. Stink bugs are blowing up. You've got the southern green. You've got the one spot. There's a lot of different ones. You've even got the marmorated stink bug coming across from the east. But what I have tried to determine, the threshold is based on when you need to treat. Generally, the threshold occurs after leaves start dropping off. And it's 1 to 3 stink bugs per foot a row. Depends on which university you talk to. But I found in a lot of research I've done that if you take 20 sweeps in July and get 2 adult stink bugs, they're going to lay enough eggs to where you're going to have about 2 stink bugs per foot a row at harvest. And I tell growers that if you go out and harvest and you see stink bugs, and a lot of times you mistaken the nymph, you don't realize the nymph is the stink bug, because the green stink bug has a kind of a mottled colored nymph. It's got a little orangish on it, a little black, and that is a stink bug. And if you see stink bugs in your combine, you've lost 8 bushels of beans. So I take those stink bugs out in June so they can't lay eggs and cause me problems at harvest. And the side effect of that is you're taking out spider mites, you're taking out things like grasshoppers, you're taking out the worm complex. No, the corn earworm oddly has a different name in soybeans. It's called soybean podworm. It's not because it feeds on leaves, it feeds on the pods. And that's really what you're trying to protect, the pods and the blooms.
Yeah, I agree. All right, how about Japanese beetles? This is another one where we've seen a lot more of here in the last few years. It seems to me that that bug is also spreading more around the country. Is that what you're seeing?
Japanese beetles are extensive. What's happening, basically, I started with them in Terre Haute, Indiana. Then they got into southern Illinois. This year in Missouri, they said a few hundred per trap catch is considered a high population. Mm-hmm. They were in the tens of thousands in the trap catches. Problem that we have is now we have all of those eggs laid. All those grubs are going to be attacking your corn,
right,
and your soybean roots. And then they're going to come out and they're going to just annihilate everything.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because there are a lot of people that don't realize they have the bug until after the eggs are laid. Then they go spray the insecticide and they think, oh, we're good, we're in the clear, we killed the bugs. You did for now. But the problem is the eggs are already there, and now next year you are going to have some issue. So it's one of the things I know you've talked about quite a bit before about just the secondary pests and using insecticide with your corn. But this would be one of the secondary pests that a BT is not going to get. So I don't know of any BT that'll kill a grub, do you?
No, there is no BT, and there's not enough in a seed treatment to actually kill a grub.
Right.
You're going to protect the seed for about 2 weeks, maybe at best, get seed out of the ground, and then that grub's just going to feed on all those little hair roots.
How about grubs in soybeans? So grubs in corn, it's pretty easy. Well, I shouldn't say easy, but we know what to do. You just use an insecticide out there. How about in soybeans? I don't find many people using insecticide at planting time in soybeans. Can they do that if they are concerned about grubs?
Yes, they can. And actually last year, I'm glad you asked me that, I put out several strip trials, large commercial strip trials, Abilene and Ohio and here in Kansas City. And we found anywhere from 3 to 5 bushel bump by controlling those grubs that are feeding on those soybean roots. We dug the roots up, washed them in a bucket, and you could take and see the actual feeding that had occurred on those soybean roots. You know, a grub doesn't sit there and wait for corn roots next year. He's going to feed on your soybean roots this year.
Right, absolutely. Are there certain areas of fields that you're seeing more problem? A lot of times where I see it is near shelter belts. Is there anything in particular where you can tell a guy, hey, you're more at risk if you have this?
Yeah, what we've been doing is we've been Of course, using our Ethos 3D product for disease control and for bug control. But like in low areas where you have moisture and you may have some weeds coming up, a lot of times that'll attract those beetles into there and they'll lay eggs right around that area. They will come out of the trees and get along the edges of the field. If you have an area where you've got a lot of turf or, you know, you've got a roadway, a lot of fields are right adjacent to interstates where there's been a lot, you know, come out of the interstate and move into the field. So there's a lot of patterns that you find. I just gave a presentation a few minutes ago. Areas that are, you know, you've got that uneven corn and not uneven bean look in the field.
Yep.
Sometimes that uneven look is diseases that are taking out those roots or mm-hmm. it's bugs taking out those roots. Mm-hmm. And if you'd protect that from diseases or bugs, that should be a nice even looking field across there. Of course, we can't do anything about drowned out areas, but we can take out and protect the root system and get those plants looking a lot healthier.
Our topic today is insect control in soybeans. We've got about a minute left, Bob. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention for us today?
Well, one of the things people need to do is buy a sweep net. It's $30 for a sweep net. Get out there right when those beans are starting to bloom and take a sweep. When I do that and show growers what they've got, then they get the airplane in the air or they get their sprayer out and they spray their beans. So make sure you scout. Scouting is very important.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. All right, well, we've been talking to Bob Hooten with FMC. Bob, thanks a lot for the time today. Appreciate it as always.
You bet. Take it easy.
You too.
Yeah, Bob's always a wealth of knowledge. There's so many different things going on around the country, and that's an interesting thing about this topic, just talking about soybean insects. Are we going to focus on aphids that the Midwest is fighting? Are we going to focus on loopers and other things that they're seeing in other parts of the country, or stink bugs? There's just quite a few different bugs, Brian. And when we look at most of these bugs, it's foliar passes that we got to make at yep. one point or another through the season. So we always get the question, can I just mix that in with my fungicide and herbicide?
In almost all cases. I do worry a little about Lohr's Man. That can get a little hot with, especially when you start putting fertilizer together with fungicide, and then you're going to throw Lohr's Man in, that gets real hot. So be careful about the mixing that you're going to do. But in many cases, yes, you can throw it in with other products that you're spraying.
We'll talk a little more about insect control in soybeans and get to the Ag PhD mailbag coming up next.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer Amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean field, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer Amaranth. Take control of your soybean field and get rewarded with Roundup Ready Plus when you choose the proven power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success, like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
1 year it could be moisture stress, another Pythium or nematodes. So you need your soybeans to rise ready for whatever the season holds. Now one simple decision provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio, fungicides, insecticides, bioenhancers, and an industry-leading nematicide that strikes where nematodes attack. This season, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at AcceleronSAS.com/rise-ready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
Are you frustrated with white mold showing up year after year in your soybeans? If you have tried fungicide applications and are still losing yield to white mold, now is the time to ask your seed dealer about Heads Up Plant Protectant. Heads Up is the first EPA-registered seed treatment for the prevention of white mold in soybeans and pulse crops. The first line of defense on your farm against white mold now starts with the right seed treatment package. Locate a Heads Up dealer near you by visiting headsupst.com today.
Come on in. The Ag PhD mailbag is about to begin.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. It is the Ag PhD mailbag time right now, taking your calls and questions throughout the rest of the show. You can give us a call at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can send us an email, radio@agphd.com. Got one from Ed today in southern Minnesota. He said, I'm raising spring wheat on very marginal ground, and grass control has been an issue for me in my spring wheat. Now, I've been looking into pre-emerge programs. In the past, I've used Everest, but I'm looking for some more info on other options. What would you think about trifluralin? It's labeled for spring wheat, and it's worked for grass control and soybeans for sure. Would it hurt my wheat crop?
Yes. Yep. Don't even dream about putting trifluralin out there. That absolutely will hurt your wheat crop. So what you want to run with, you certainly could do Zidua or Anthem. Let's see, I got to think about the right product. Anthem Flex would be Zidua and AIM. So that's a group 15. So if you wanted to do something completely different, you certainly could do that. Now that's a lot more money than going out there with Prepare, which is the same thing as the old Everest. You could run Prepare at 0.2 to 0.3 ounces. You're going to spend $3.50 to $5. So that's the cheapest way to go. That's an ALS. And then you follow post-emerge with something like Axial or Discover that is an ACCase. So you got two different chemical families, two different modes of action on your grass, either Zidua or, so group 15, or run that ALS Prepare early and then follow later on with an ACCase. Grass will no longer be a problem in your wheat if you do that.
The other thing, Ed, is just in your rotation, make sure you're wiping out grass completely in your other crops. And I know a lot of times when wheat is in the rotation, we talk to growers and say, man, I'm nervous about running residual grass herbicides in the other part of my rotation because I don't want to have any kind of carryover to my small grains. I would just say this, even if you're using a cut rate of some of the pre's in the other programs, make sure you're doing an awesome job on the post-emerge side. If you're using Roundup Ready or Liberty Link corn and soybeans, you've got those options post-emerge to just completely wipe grass out so it doesn't go to seed. So that would be something I'd recommend. The other thing that I'd look at is just trying to make sure you're getting an excellent crop canopy with your wheat and doing everything you can fertility-wise, planting date-wise, and so forth. Just to jump that wheat out of the ground, get it ahead of those grasses, and shade them out. The crop canopy is still the best weed control you can get. Thanks for the questions. Chad up in North Dakota has got a couple of things for us today, Brian. He said, I got a soil test question for you, and then I've got a water question for you. First of all, the soil test. I sent you a soil test a while back that had where I put drainage tile in, dramatically reduced levels of sodium and soluble salts. I also did another field where I just used a subsoiler. I didn't use any gypsum or apply any kind of soil amendments. I just did subsoiling to see what would happen. I did get the base saturation of sodium to go down, but my soluble salt levels certainly did not change like they did where I got the drainage tile in. Do you see differences that way normally, or do you think I need to have tile in this ground as well?
Yesterday, I was in Fargo, North Dakota. The number one thing that the average farmer in the Red River Valley, North Dakota, and Minnesota needs to do to increase yield, or let me rephrase that. The thing they need to do that will make the most money is put in drain tile. So the most common question I get there is, well, what if I don't want to drain tile or put drain tile in? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. We need to lower the water table. That is number one. Now, for Chad, and in fact, I was literally just talking to some farmers yesterday about his email and about his results, because I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, they're promising, and if I just do deep tillage, it's going to solve my need for putting drain tile in. No, no, no. But if, let's say, you have a U.S. Fish and Wildlife wetland easement that is permanent, and out of your quarter section you need to tile, you can only tile 120 acres because there are 40 acres that are either affected by that permanent easement directly or indirectly, because you have to leave a little area around that spot. So if I had 40 acres left that I can't put tile in legally, then what I'm going to do is, yes, I'm absolutely going to take a look at deep tillage. Now, the other thing that I mentioned to farmers yesterday is take a look at what's your calcium percentage. If I'm at a calcium percentage of, in like just for Chad's stuff here, he's at as low as 52% calcium and as high as 37% magnesium. Over time, and you know, I'm not going to do this instantly because it's not going to pay right away, but over time, over let's say the next 20 years, then I'm going to be working on increasing my calcium levels. I'm going to probably throw some more gypsum out there, and I'm going to do everything I can to raise my calcium. That's going to increase the porosity of the soil. But let's put it this way. I got this question yesterday. It actually might have been during the radio show. And somebody said, okay, well, what if I have, you know, really high sodium level and I can't tile? And I just said, well, that sounds to me like ground you should let your brother farm. You know, and everybody kind of laughs. And I go, no, seriously, I have very little interest in continuing to farm that ground. If I can sell it for good money now, I would, because long term, if I can't get rid of that sodium, the problem's going to build and build and build, and eventually the soil's going to be dead. So your other option is this. Put it into CRP or something where you can have some permanent crop growing, and hopefully it continues to grow. Maybe it's a more tolerant crop to sodium. I mean, you got to do something out there to try to recover some of the money you've invested. But ideally, I'd just as soon dump that ground, go buy something else for similar money where I can put tile in and actually fix it long term. Because if you start getting those sodium levels up or soluble salt levels up, you got a major issue. And yes, deep tillage can help because you can get rid of, or I shouldn't even say get rid of, you can make some slices out there through your compaction layers and allow some stuff to get down a little bit deeper in the soil, and that's good, and that may temporarily help you. But long term, you have to fix the drainage, because high water table is what's killing you. And I don't care how much you fix your compaction, how much deep tillage you do, you're not going to solve the problem of a high water table with simply that. So long term, tile's still the answer.
All right, Chad's other question was around water, and this is more about spray applications. He said, we've done some reading about water pH and how that may affect the plant uptake of foliar nutrition that you're applying.
Yep.
I'm wondering about how it might impact fungicide applications for crops like canola, soybeans, and corn. Our water pH is close to 9 on our rural water network, and I don't believe we're adjusting that much with the other things we're adding to the spray tank.
Probably not. I've never seen anything on fungicide. I have seen plenty on getting foliar fertilizer into plants. It's interesting that you bring this up today, because on Tuesday we're going to talk during our Secrets of High Yield Fields workshop, which we'd love to have you attend. But during that workshop, I'm going to show you some test results from rainwater, where even though people say we don't have acid rain anymore, you know what? The rainwater that landed on our farm last year, we tested it, it's in the 5s for pH. The water in the river right now is around 7. The water out of wells is 8+. So there's a dramatic difference there. And occasionally we will get people say, boy, I'm using rainwater now and my stuff is working better. Okay, well, maybe it's because it needs to be acidified. And so you can do that with treatments. And what I would suggest to you is maybe run some tests yourselves. I don't know that I'm going to be doing any of those tests this year on fungicide, but you certainly could real easily get some citric acid if you want to lower your soil or lower your water pH down from that 9 in the water you're using. Otherwise, like I say, you could pull some out of the river that's probably 7, or just catch a bunch of rainwater. And I realize you're in a dry area of the country, so maybe you won't catch much. But you could catch some rainwater, and if you can use that, that would be great. That's probably a pretty low pH.
All right, thanks for the questions, Chad. We really appreciate that. And if you're thinking about your farm right now and what's going to happen this spring coming up when you start planting, and you've got questions, send them to us in the Ag PhD Radio mailbag. Radio at agphd.com is where you go with that. You can send in soil samples. I got a couple of soil samples I'm going to get to here shortly. Or just other situations that are happening on the farm. We'd love to weigh in and see if we can help. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to growsmartrewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic is proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to agroliquid.com to move you closer to your target.
In order to be the best farmer you can be, you've got to have a grain marketing plan. But what do you do when you're too busy out in the fields trying to maximize yield? Hi, I'm Darren Hefty. My brother Brian and I are always busy learning more about how to make our farm more successful. That's why we use Grain PhD to learn more about grain marketing and to work with our Grain PhD risk expert to create a complete grain marketing strategy. Visit grainphd.com to learn more about a free consultation for your operation.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. We're answering your calls and questions throughout the rest of the show at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can send us an email, radio at agphd.com. Got an email from Dave along with a soil test, and he said, I've attended your agronomy meetings the last couple of winters and have always enjoyed them. I have a question for you on a field that I'm working on building up my base saturation K level. I'd like to get up to that 4 to 8% range. I got a long ways to go. I was down around 1.1% on this soil test I'm sending you from 2016. I intended to get my soil test pulled again this fall, but of course we got too wet and the ground froze up and on and on. So didn't get that done yet. But since that particular test, I've put on 500 total pounds of potash and 2 tons of lime per acre, trying to bring the pH up a little bit. I also put on 50 pounds per acre of elemental sulfur, not necessarily to lower the soil pH, but just to try to help with nutrient release and build my sulfur levels as well. I had 200 bushel corn on the field this year, so I was pretty happy with that. My questions going forward here on the lime and other things, am I on the right track with this? I'm going to be raising soybeans. Should I be doing variable rate lime as we go, or do you feel like I could just put it across the whole field?
No, you absolutely want to do variable rate lime. He has one spot as high as 6.3. He has several spots that are 6+. Do not put lime across the whole thing. We did that. It's cost us all kinds of yield and money.
Well,
and
it takes lime for that lime. It takes time for that lime to come available too. So don't jump the gun if you put on lime. And I don't know which year you did that. If you did that in 2017 or whatnot, you probably got a couple more years before you can really evaluate what totally happened with that.
Yeah.
He was wondering what are the thoughts about improving.
Hold up, we got to qualify that. So this is Wisconsin, correct?
I don't have the data.
At the top of this, it says Wisconsin.
Looks like it's Wisconsin. He didn't say in his.
Yeah, so that's my assumption here. Wisconsin is cold. Wisconsin is a little bit drier than some areas of the country. Now, if we're in South Dakota, or let's take North Dakota, for example. North Dakota is way drier than Wisconsin, and North Dakota is one of the coldest states in the United States. So if I compare that to, let's say, Alabama, where I'm hot and wet, lime in Alabama is going to break down way, 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 way faster than and come available. It's going to be much faster than in North Dakota. So, yeah, where Darren says, okay, it might take 2 or 3 years or maybe 4 for that lime to break down, that's probably true in Wisconsin. It might take even more time in North Dakota, and it's going to take much less time in Alabama. So it's all relative. I just want you to be thinking about that a little bit when he makes that statement. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
All right, a couple of things I noticed on the base saturation, Brian. When we look, can you read those base saturation numbers off that test? I underlined that. I don't see hydrogen in there, and if we've got an acid pH, we should be seeing some hydrogen in that base saturation.
Yep, calcium 85%, magnesium 13.9%, and so 14%, and potassium 1%. So our potassium is ridiculously low, but it's not an accurate base saturation because you're missing sodium and you're missing hydrogen.
Yeah, so that kind of throws us off a little bit, and that's one of the challenges that we see. We get so many soil tests from a variety of labs around the country, and a lot of them do things fairly similarly, but some have some tweaks like this one,
right,
where they didn't include some of the other things we'd like to see in base saturation.
Right.
Okay. The other question Dave had is just what do you see from looking at my tests? It's obviously some peat ground when we've got organic matter as high as, what was it, 47% or something in part of the field.
Yeah.
He said on peat ground like this, what are your thoughts and suggestions on trying to improve things? We're at a 200 bushel corn level, so it's not like we're hurting, but we'd sure like to get better.
Probably the number one thing we're going to tell you is band your fertilizer. It's very possible and probably quite likely that almost anything you throw out there is going to get tied up in the ridiculously high amount of calcium that you've got. So banding your fertilizer there makes a tremendous amount of sense. Now, obviously you can't band if you are in a drilled crop or ultra narrow rows, but if you're in 30-inch rows on corn and soybeans, I'm banding, you'll get better response for the fertilizer that you apply.
All right. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, just continue to look at everything, not just N, P, and K like a lot of people want to talk about. So, for example, on this soil test, his boron is ridiculously low. His manganese is pretty low. And I don't see anything
for
copper or iron.
On that kind of ground, you should be able to hold a lot of micros. So, you know, by getting some micros out there, they're not going away.
Well, yeah, his zinc levels are actually pretty decent. But, I mean, with boron, I think that's where you were going with this, is boron is somewhat leachable. But when you've got cation exchange capacity that's very high, it's not going to leach very fast at all. And especially when you're in Wisconsin and you get some rain, but, you know, usually you're not getting super crazy excessive rains.
All right. Well, Dave, thank you so much. Really appreciate your questions on that field. If you got other questions, of course, radio@agphd.com is our email address. Got one here. This came in from Justin, and he's working with another farmer as well on this. He said, I got 2 samples here, and our local NRCS rep was helping us out. So this is from a field where we have low P and K in the plant tissue, but we've got pretty high levels in the soil. I'm wondering what it takes to make that happen in a field. If you've got a bunch in the soil, that's not getting in the plant. He said the only explanation that I have is that we did have record rainfall this year, and maybe our root system just wasn't huge. But can you think of any other situations where you'd have a lot in the soil and not enough in the plant?
Yeah, I'm looking for, what's his soil pH here? I don't see.
I don't know that it has it, because that's plant tissue.
No, it has it. It hasn't. He's got a 5.9 pH. Okay, so there's part of your answer. Your pH is just a little on the low side, which is going to make some nutrients, like phosphorus, for example, a little less available. Now, when you say you've got a lot, this is 104 parts per million, but I don't know what test we're running. I don't know what extraction method we're running. And so what I'm trying to say here is that might be a P2 test. It might be a strong Bray test. I don't know. I want to know what's your available P1 phosphorus. That would help me a little bit. Here's the other thing. When we start talking about plant tissue analysis, I have one test here. What I want to see is one test every week for at least 12 weeks over the course of the summer, and then we'll have a much better understanding, are we actually low or not? Also, the ratings that people come out with are based on usually just the average of all the tests that have come in. Okay, so who sends tests in? It's usually people with problems. So where I'm going with this is you might think you're low and you're actually not low. You might think you're high and you're actually not high. I don't really know. So there's a tremendous amount of variability in the rating scales on in terms of tissue testing. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want you to tissue test. I do. So at least you've got some data, but it's your data and you're going to need to make some correlations with that, and you can make correlations with that the more data you have. But your potassium levels, I would not call them high at all. I don't see a base saturation test here, but I just have a difficult time telling anybody that 315 parts per million is tremendously high. I'm sitting here looking on his soil test to see if I can find cation exchange capacity. You know, how heavy this ground is, how much organic matter, I don't know. So yeah, the 315 might be really good, it might be low. If you've got very heavy soil, 315 is not gonna cut it. So I just don't know necessarily. But here's one other thing. When you say, well, what could cause me to be low in the plant tissue? How good are your roots? How much compaction do you have? Is your plant actively growing? If it's not actively growing, because of something else, there could be bug feeding, diseases, injury from a herbicide. There's so many things that can affect the overall uptake. It's really hard to say with the limited amount of data that I've got here. But yes, it does appear like on phosphorus, 104 parts per million sounds good, but I don't know what extraction method that is. So anyway, yeah, he might actually be okay, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to know. And I guess if you wanted to run a complete soil analysis, we use Midwest Labs. We use the S3C test, and that one would give all the micros and all the other things that Brian was talking about. It's not a super expensive test. I think if you just send one in, it's like $26 or something. But you could find out what's going on there. And you can go out and pull that soil sample again in the same spot. And it's not going to vary much from when you did pull that first one. Thanks for the question, Justin. Yeah, it's always tricky to figure out, well, what happened in my field last year? And having a little bit of data like this is helpful, and seeing what those plants look like is helpful. The good thing is we're setting some of those plans up now to try to avoid some of these things, because yes, just because you've got nutrients in the soil doesn't necessarily mean they're going to make it into the plant. Well, thanks for listening to our show today. Really appreciate all the questions that came in. And if you've got a question, again, radio@agphd.com is our mailbag. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.